There's always a sense of relief when Easter morning comes, isn't there? After we gathered together on Good Friday, and yesterday is kind of, you know, Holy Saturday is a very silent day. You've had Good Friday to consider the cross, and then there's this day of waiting for Sunday to come. I often find myself on Holy Saturday going, what am I supposed to do today? Because there is this sense of, I want to move on and I want to move forward. Both in the Easter season, but just in life in general, I think. We've been on a pilgrimage as a parish over the last number of months, working our way through understanding who Jesus is, what he has accomplished, and the implications and benefits and impact of what he's done. And it led to kind of a low point on Friday. A low point of going, here's our life story. Understanding that we've been living for much of our lives trying to provide for ourselves, trying to be enough for ourselves. We've separated ourselves from the source of life, our Creator, and we've sought instead to try and do it in our own means, to try and be strong enough, to try and be good enough. And as we have kids and as we get grandkids, the pressure gets greater, doesn't it? Things get bigger than our abilities, don't it? And we realize however strong my hands were at the beginning and however far my arms could reach, life goes to the point where you can't reach it all, you can't control it all, and you're not strong enough for all of it. That's a healthy realization. But in doing so, we start to realize that we've taken on a yoke of responsibility that we can't carry. And it breaks us. It breaks our hearts. It overwhelms our minds. And it exhausts our abilities and our bodies. And so Friday, Good Friday, was that low point of going, I recognize that I've lived apart from my Creator for a long time. I recognize in these parts of my life that I've been trying to do it by myself. And I recognize the toll that it's taken on my soul. My heart's broken and bruised. My mind is running out of ideas. And my body's tired. But we took the risk as a people to see the connection between our tiredness, our sorrow, our grief, our regrets, and saw the connection between those and the cross of Jesus. We let his suffering and his death consume ours. So we saw all of our sins and mistakes of the past, all of our weariness and sorrow. Not only did Jesus understand us in the midst of our pain, but he consumed it, took it into himself, and was crucified in order to kill what has been killing us. Are you with me? But there's death in that, isn't there? That letting go and the humility to realize I couldn't have done this all along in the first place. And the willingness to go, I will die with Jesus. I will stop trying to be enough for myself. And Saturday, we just sit in it. We sit in it and we wait. And we hope that by believing in Jesus enough to die with him, that God will bring us back to life. That's what we're hoping for. That's what we're looking forward to. If we put ourselves into the position of the disciples, those closest to Jesus, imagine the arc of this whole story, right? Meeting Jesus and feeling known like you've never felt known before in your life. That you feel simultaneously incredibly comfortable and at home with Jesus, as though you were always meant to be with him, but also really challenged. You find yourself saying things in front of Jesus that you wish you didn't say out loud. You find that it draws you out, even in your mistakes. Just the sheer power of who he is, just in friendship, but then seeing his miracles, seeing him turn one loaf of bread enough to feed thousands, seeing him walk on water and heal the sick and the blind. This is the Jesus they're experiencing. Coming into Jerusalem, the capital city, and all of the city lays down their cloaks and palm branches in order to welcome him in as a conquering king. Is it fair to say there's a lot of hope and expectation in that moment? Right? So here they are putting all of their dreams, all of their needs, and their desires onto Jesus, rightly. That he actually draws it out of you, makes you hope for a different life, makes you hope for radical change in this life. Do you find that Jesus does that? When you hear the gospel, it's like, you don't have to stay broken. You don't have to live on the meager means that you have inside. You don't have to be so sorrowful about the past. It draws hope out of you. Okay? So, and then at the height of their hope and their expectations and what they're looking forward to, what happens? He's crucified. So now all of these followers who have allowed their hearts to hope for a new and different way are now suddenly crushed in disappointment. Talk about a bait and switch. Right? Jesus saying, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. If you follow me, springs of living water will flow out of you. And now, he's arrested, tortured, beaten, mocked, spit upon, whipped, and crucified naked. That's a deep plummet into disappointment and despair. Fair? Yeah. And so here's where the disciples find themselves. So Friday, they see their hope die, crushed. And he's buried in a tomb. And Saturday, nothing happens. Saturday is silent. Where's Jesus? Where's all the hope we put? Imagine the soul-crushing silence. For some of them, there's such a deep love for Jesus that even in his death, they go to his tomb to continue grieving. And that's the story that we find ourselves in today. Is that Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb to continue grieving. But what she finds is a tomb open. That's a little disconcerting. Imagine going to a graveside and finding it open. That's not exactly comforting, is it? So here she goes, the tomb is open, and she looks inside and it's empty. So she runs back to essentially, all of these disciples and friends of Jesus had gathered together in their grief and confusion. And she runs back to them to say, he's not there. Now, this is John's gospel that we're reading today. I love that John takes the time to say, him and Peter run to the tomb, but Peter's not quite as fast as John is. I love the way John's kind of like, just for the record so you know, I made it there first. As much zeal as Peter had, it wasn't enough to quite get him there before me. So here, John and Peter run and find the same thing, an open tomb. The grave clothes are laying on there. I love the little detail of the fact that the cloth that was upon his face is folded and placed. Some intentionality. But then they leave, and following again for the second time is Mary. Verse 11, she's weeping outside the tomb, and as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb. What she sees here is interesting, considering all that we know of the Old Testament scriptures. Here's a Jewish woman, found her Savior in Jesus, who has now been crucified. Now she looks into his grave. What she sees is two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. So what essentially Mary sees is this stone grave bed, and sitting on each end of it is an angel. So square surface, and on each side an angel. Now for a Jewish person, what imagery does this call to mind? It's the Ark of the Covenant. So in the Old Testament, the Ark of the Covenant was meant to be the place that the law of God was held. It's probably... For most of you, when you think of the Ark of the Covenant, you think of Indiana Jones. Right? It's kind of the iconic in film where we get to see it. So, and they actually did a good job of staying true to the biblical design of it. But the way it worked, it was an ark that was meant to carry the law, the Ten Commandments of God, and that it was the centerpiece of the temple. And there, the presence of God would dwell. And on top of this box, this elaborate box, were two cherubim, two angels, which faced each other with wings outstretched. What we see here that John alludes to, that Mary is seeing, is that God's presence is dwelling somewhere different. The Old Testament, whenever it talks about God's presence, it's more about how you don't have access to it than that you do. The temple is constructed in such a way that certain people can only go in certain places. And even the high priest can only go into the presence of God once a year, and that's to offer sacrifice. And he better be ready. He better be pure. He better be sanctified. And he better follow instructions. Think of the contrast of what we're seeing, of going the presence of God only being accessible to one once a year, to now we're seeing the presence of God communicated as being in a grave, as being in a place of death, as being in an unclean place. Think of the Nazirite vows in the Old Testament. If you touched a dead body, you became unclean and were unfit even to be in the temple for a time. Now what's being communicated here is that the place of death, the place of curse, the place of finality and hopelessness now houses the Holy of Holies, God's very presence. This communicates what's at the heart of the gospel. Not only does Christ enter into your story in order to take all of that cancer that's consumed your heart through the years and through trauma and through hardship and through pain and through massive mistakes and failures. He not only knows you the way you wish to be known, understands you the way you wish to be understood, But he takes all of that out of you, kills it upon the cross, and then buries it in a grave. That it would never see the light of day again. Is that not relieving in and of itself? That's the promise of the gospel, that even on a daily basis, the pain, the sorrow, the hardship of your day could find solution in the cross of Jesus. But he's not done there. What we see here is that because of Jesus' perfect sacrifice, the heart of God gets revealed here, that his very presence and the very source of all power and strength in the universe would descend upon the most broken parts of your life. The parts of you that struggle the most, that you can't create change in, that you can't change your thoughts and you can't escape your feelings and destructive patterns of living. All of those places, the gospel communicates that God wants to give his full power, life, and presence to help you in that place. The presence of God that mankind once had no access to now goes to the deepest, darkest parts of us because we believed in the cross of Jesus. This means, when we look at the Old Testament, we often think of God's presence, right? So God present, the very source of our beginning, the very source of life that we so desperately need. Who finds themselves on a day-to-day basis going, I don't have enough to do today. I don't have enough strength for today. I don't have enough will for today. I don't have enough confidence for today. Who feels that? Or is that just Mondays? Right? So that feeling of going, I'm not tapping into the source of life that I so desperately need. In the Old Testament, it's kind of communicated that we have limited access to that because we've chosen to live independent. We've chosen to say, I don't need that source, I'll be my own source, which is why we often feel so tired, so stressed, so overwhelmed, and so exhausted. Can you see that? When Christians say sin, that's what we mean. We mean we've chosen to live without him, without our source, without our strength. Because of that, there's a separation then. Sin has separated us from our source. Jesus, though, does this work of bringing us back into contact. So we have access to that place of presence. We have access to that dwelling place of power. We have access to live from the source, which is God. So much so that when Christ dies and the temple curtain is torn, from top to bottom, and it says the presence of God doesn't dwell here anymore. Where it's gone is it's descended upon the death of Jesus in order to raise him back to life. And in doing so, gives us all the promise of a new way of living, a new source of life. That instead of trusting in us all the time, we have a new place, a new resource to live from and for. So what is the impact of the resurrection for us? For those who are willing to die with Christ and so be raised with Christ, it means God takes responsibility to bring you back from this. It means every area of your life that you confessed to failing in, to struggling in, he now works to make you able, to give you the will and the strength and the ability to do what's good, what's right, what's fruitful. That he would make us a holy people, meaning that our potential is glory. That's how good he wants to make us. That it's the power of God, not only for the deep places of our heart and our mind, but that we'd actually see the power of God in our circumstances. We'd see the power of God in him resurrecting all things, not just us. To the point where we would actually see Jesus resurrect the whole creation. And resurrect all things for all eternity. Because when you connect this world with its true source of life, life goes on forever. That's the picture that's given in the resurrection of Jesus. So the good news for us today is that every area that you risked so much to be honest about and confess in your life, where you've been trying to do it on your own, now all of God is working towards bringing that part of your life back to life. He's not just taking you deep. He's now taking you high. Now it's about hope. Now it's about joy. Where we were honest about the discouragement within, about hopelessness and pain and sorrow, now the focus of the gospel is on joy and peace and fulfillment and confidence and strength, that you would know those things in what used to be a grave, would now be a house of life, a house of wholeness. Now we have to shift gears as a people where we doggedly go after strength and doggedly go after hope and doggedly believe that there's victory over darkness. That we're made for more than this. We have underappreciated the significant impact of the resurrection to day-to-day life. But it sounds so far like we might still be sleeping in the grave this morning. You're thinking really hard, aren't you? But here's what I want you to hear as we close. Don't try so hard to figure it out. Try to give yourself to it. Try to just say yes. That our response to this good news of Jesus coming back from the dead is not, wait a second, how do we figure this out? You did what? Our response of faith should just be a yes. Thank God. I want in on this. That's the response we want to have. I'll go into historical things in the next few weeks and practical proofs of the resurrection and all of those implications and outcomes. We're going to cover that in the next number of weeks. But today, let our response just be a yes, I'm in. Are you in? Because it's so good. And we have a bright future ahead of us because of the resurrection, don't we? We have a bright future. This parish has a bright future, doesn't it? And it's all based upon this victory that we celebrate today. So what we're going to do now is I wanted to take some time as a people, as a family, to renew our baptismal vows. The Christian baptism is that place where we participate with Jesus in his death, his burial, and his resurrection. And that's figurative of it. It's a sign and a symbol. But it's that practical experience where we go, this is who I am now. I see myself not based on my story. I see myself based on Jesus' story. I see that my old life is dead, my old way of living, and my new life is hidden in Jesus, that he's my source. And so following this worship song and the offertory, we'll do a baptismal vow renewal, and then we'll partake of the Lord's table together. Okay? Let's stand together and let's worship. Thank you. Stay standing. Through the Paschal mystery, dear friends, we are buried with Christ by baptism into his death and raised with him to newness of life. I call upon you, therefore, now that our Lenten observance is ended, to renew the solemn promises and vows of holy baptism, by which we once renounced the devil and all his works, and promise to serve God faithfully in his one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. Do you here in the presence of God and the Church renew the solemn promises and vows made at your baptism and commit yourself to keep them?
I do.